Thank you very much. Okay, so of course this is a blackboard talk, so of course it's much easier to do these things with transparencies. But and I cannot give you here exhaustive list of references. In fact, I'm going to focus on a very narrow aspects of graphene physics, and most of what I'm going to talk about has to do with this paper we published on Physics World, which relates the aspects of graphene, condensed matter graphene, with particle physics. And actually, I may be able to touch on some aspects of this problem of the quantum aspects, the quantum nature of space-time singularities, which is, maybe it's related, I don't know. I mean, there are so many things here. So, as I said, but this is not exhaustive, and I'm not going to talk about very interesting subjects like superconductivity in graphene, graphene in high magnetic fields, and things like that. So it's not, I'm certain you can find on ConMet a huge amount of paper. Actually, there are more than 260 papers on graphene in the last year or so. So it's a huge explosion. And in fact, the next March meeting in Denver, there's going to be 3 invited sessions plus 7 focus sections, all papers on graphene. So I cannot possibly cover all that. It's absolutely impossible. So I'm going to have to be very, very focused. And also, I'm not going to give a very, I'm not giving the talks for the experts on graphene, so please, I apologize, because I'm going to talk about very simple things and things that I can explain on the blackboard in a short period of time. So, graphene, as the name indicates, comes from graphite, and I'm sure everybody in this room has experience with graphite. When you write with a lead pencil, you are dealing with graphite and you are dealing with graphene, in fact. Huh? It's graphite mixed with some sort of sand. I don't know. There's some something like that. But anyway, so graphite is just a highly layered system made out of these planes. And these planes are graphene. Each plane on the graphite is graphene, and the thing about the structure of the graphene layer is that it's a honeycomb lattice. So
actually, I'm pretty sure that
you guys are going to see lots of these plots of the honeycomb lattice. Whoops, wrong. Right, and the honeycomb lattice. What happens here is that at each vertex here, I have a carbon, and this carbon couples to the other carbons by sigma orbitals, which have this 120 degree angle between them, and this essentially forms the valence band of graphene. So the conduction band is actually generated by the pi orbitals, which stick out of the plane. Okay. And in the simplest approximation, you can think that the electrons just hop between next nearest neighbor atoms. Okay, so the electrons, there is an overlap of the wave function between these nearest neighbor atoms, and there is an energy associated with the hopping of the electrons between these two atoms. Now, one interesting thing about the honeycomb lattice is that it has 2 atoms per unit cell. Okay, so actually you have 2 sublattices. Let's call A and B. Okay, and the whole lattice you can cover by this unit cell. And the nearest neighbor hopping between atoms actually happens between atoms on different sublattices. Okay, so in this hopping process, the characteristic energy scale that I call T, okay, I'm going to call T, is a number of order of 3 electron volts. All right? And so this energy scale it's the dominant energy scale for the motion of the electrons here. You, of course, you can have hoppings between orbitals on the same sublattice. For instance, you can hop from here to there, but this is a hopping which is one order of magnitude smaller. So most of the robust feature of graphene is that it's characterized by this energy scale here, and much of the physics of this material can be described in terms of a very simple model with a single hopping. Okay? And this is the kind of problem we give to our students in first year solid state, which is to calculate the band structure of this. It's a very simple problem. You can calculate this on tight binding. I'm not going to do it here, but I'm going to sketch how it looks like. So if you look in momentum space, let's say kx, ky, the Brillouin zone of the first Brillouin zone of graphene, it has also an hexagonal shape. And the thing is that there is one electron per pi orbital. So this is exactly a half-filled band. Okay? And what happens is that if you look at where the band structure close to the chemical potential, all right? So what happens is that you have linearly dispersing around the edges of the Brillouin zone. Okay? So in fact, you have two different points in the Brillouin zone which are not equivalent. Say this one associated with this one and associated with these other three points. And actually you can use reciprocal lattice vectors to actually take, for instance, this one-third here of a cone and put it here, and this to put there, and you can do the same here. And what you end up with are two cones at opposite sides of the Brillouin zone. Okay, so if you plot the energy dispersion in momentum space, so kx, ky, what you have is a cone like that. Okay, and so the energy, in fact, so you have two bands, you have an upper band and a lower band in this problem, and the energy of these two bands is just plus or minus Vf, which is the slope of this cone times the momentum, the modulo of the momentum. Okay, and this Fermi, this velocity here, you can calculate is 3/2 of the hopping energy times the lattice spacing, and this is a number of order of 10^6 meters per second. Okay, so you can calculate this slope, and that's what you get. And this is very isotropic in momentum space, this dispersion. Okay, so in fact, this description of graphene, as I said, is a textbook problem, and it was solved in 1947 by Wallace already. The reason why Wallace was studying this is that he was working for the Canadian nuclear program, and they were interested in graphite. Okay, because graphite is used as a moderator in nuclear reactors. So he was studying graphite, and his starting point was graphene, because the coupling between these graphene layers is extremely weak. It's made by essentially van der Waals forces. There is also a covalent coupling, but most of the coupling is van der Waals. So it's a good starting point, he believed. In fact, there would be a good starting point for graphite. So actually, we can do a little bit.
Is the Fermi level zero?
Yes, exactly at the Dirac point. So the Fermi level crosses right there. Okay? In neutral graphene, it crosses exactly that. So you have essentially exactly the Dirac problem. And in fact, you can expand the energy close to these points here in the Brillouin zone. And you find that the Hamiltonian, this is the single particle Hamiltonian, is just the Fermi velocity times a 2/2 matrix, like that. just the Dirac Hamiltonian in two dimensions, right? That I can write VF times Pauli matrix times Q. Okay? Very simple, extremely simple Hamiltonian. And if you want to go to, of course, to in real space, you just have sigma I dot two-dimensional gradient. Okay, so it's just very simple Hamiltonian. And of course, one can solve this Hamiltonian, and what you get is this spectrum. Okay, so if I solve this Hamiltonian here, I have VF sigma dot Q applied on the wave function. And the point is that this wave function, these are 2x2 matrices, this wave function is a spinor. Okay, so it has a two component. And you find that this is, you have two solutions, one associated with the upper band and another with the lower band. And this is just VF plus or minus VF times Q times the wave function back. Okay? So very simple problem. And an interesting thing about this problem here is that if I drop the VF on it and I divide it by Q, so now this is the unit vector in the direction of the momentum. Okay, you can see that this Pauli matrix can only have its projection plus or minus one in the direction of the unit vector. Okay, so that defines a helicity or chirality for the problem. So the upper, the particles in the upper cone are, say, right-handed, and the ones in the left cone are left-handed. So this is exactly what you would expect in, say, neutrino physics, where you have the neutrinos are left, right-handed, and the antineutrinos are left-handed. But here there is the other cone. This is only valid for the this cone, but this cone is related to that by time reversal symmetry, so which means that for the other cone, the helicity is inverted. So what was left-handed on one is right-handed on the other, and vice versa. This is the two-component. Yeah. So it has to do with exactly with the fact that you have two atoms per unit cell. Okay. So the wave function for this can be calculated immediately. There is no problem. So the wave function is just theta. It's just a spinor like that. And of course, being a spinor, this has the property that if you rotate the angle by 2 pi, you get a minus sign. Right? So if you rotate this, theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, the wave function goes to minus the wave function, which is the property that you expect for spinors. Okay? So, in fact, this property of the fact that the wave function is a spinor, is a two-component object, has effects, for instance, when you apply a magnetic field to the system, right? Because essentially this is like a gauge transformation in the problem. So you can imagine now, for instance, applying, and that's actually what was done experimentally, you can have one of these graphene planes and apply a magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. And the obvious extension to this is to add the vector potential to the problem. So in the presence of a perpendicular magnetic field, the Hamiltonian is just VF sigma dot I E over. That's it, just like in the usual Dirac problem. And for instance, if the simplest thing is to work, for instance, in the Landau gauge. And you see that as in the non-relativistic problem, the magnetic field introduces a length scale, right? You just see from here. And this length scale is the cyclotron length, right? So the cyclotron length, which is just square root of E over B times C. So that there is nothing new about that. But you see that from here is that when you put this in a magnetic field, the only quantity that you can get with dimensions of energy, since the only thing you have is this length scale and the Fermi velocity, the only thing with dimensions of energy that you can get is VF over the magnetic length. And this essentially sets the scale for the cyclotron frequency. There is actually a factor of square root of 2 that goes in there when you quantize this properly. Okay? But essentially, you have the problem reduces to that. And this is an extremely simple problem to solve. Just, again, writing everything in the Landau gauge and diagonalizing. And you find that the spectrum, actually, of this is omega c square root of n, where n is an integer. Okay? It's an extremely simple problem. The first thing to notice is the energy scale here. Because since the cyclotron energy goes like 1 over the cyclotron length, this quantity scales like the square root of the magnetic field. In a non-relativistic problem, of course, the cyclotron energy scales like 1 over the cyclotron length square, because you have a parabolic dispersion. Right? So this actually scales like B itself. So the cyclotron energy has a completely different energy dependence with the magnetic field, and this has experimental consequences, of course. For instance, if you're talking about fields of order of 10 Tesla, for a non-relativistic problem, this energy scale might be of order of 1 Kelvin. But because of the square root dependence, the energy scale becomes of order of 1,000 Kelvin. So it's three orders of magnitude bigger. Okay? And, of course, this has consequences, for instance, for the measurement of the Hall effect, for instance. Okay, another thing to notice here is that the Dirac spectrum in a magnetic field has a zero mode, has a state exactly at zero energy. Okay, and actually this was, I think that the first reference I know talking about this is this paper by Roman Jacquiv here in 84, where he talks exactly about the problem of zero modes in the Dirac problem in a magnetic field. So essentially you see that if I plot the energy now, I have quantized energy levels, right? But they are not uniform because of the square root dependence here. So for instance, I have one here, omega c, square root of 2 times omega c, and so on and so forth. Here is minus omega c, minus 2 square root of 2 omega c, and so on and so forth. Right? So it's the spectrum is not uniform. And actually, this allows us immediately to get the integer quantum Hall effect. How you do that? So this is done using an argument due to Bert Halperin, 82. Very simple argument. So imagine now I cut this graphene in a finite size L. Okay? And I have this magnetic field perpendicular here. Now, because the system ends, the electrons are confined to the inside of this graphene strip. So what happens is, now if I plot, so in the bulk of this strip, I'm going to have this spectrum. Now you ask yourself, what happens as I get close to the edge? Okay? And what happens is that, so if I have some edge here, I cannot have states on this side. So this is now, let's call this X, right? So this is, say, L over 2, and here's minus L over 2. So this is a function of X. What's going to happen, it's pretty clear. So these levels, which are above 0, have to turn up, okay, because of the confining potential of the graphene sheet, right? And the levels which are below have to go in the other direction, like that. So the question is, what happens to the zero energy mode? And what happens, it's very simple. You see that I have this spectrum. It doesn't matter which cone I work with. I have exactly the same spectrum. So these Landau levels are doubly degenerate. okay, because I have two of these cones. So actually, this level, when approaches the edge, has to split. That's the only thing it can do, nothing else. So this level is actually also split as well. Okay? And what happens is that if you are at some finite chemical potential here, right, you always have an odd number of states at the edge of the graphene strip. You cannot escape from that. Okay, so you have always, whatever, 2n plus 1 of these edge states. Now, if you go through Halperin's argument of the quantization of the Hall conductivity, right? So essentially, you only have, these are like one-dimensional channels, right? And the Hall conductivity has essentially to be proportional to E squared over H times the number of channels. So sigma xy has to be 2n plus 1 E squared over H. Right? If you have spin, you have a factor of 2 here in front. Okay, that's the integer quantum Hall effect. The naive expectation that you would expect for a non-relativistic electron gas would be the absence of this one here. But the presence of the zero mode in this problem changes everything. Okay? So this is essentially the integer quantum Hall effect. And you can see that this is a direct consequence of the Dirac nature of these particles. Okay? All right. So this is all nice and simple, and of course, we would be doing very abstract work here if it was not by this paper, Kostya Novoselov and his colleagues at Andre Geim's group in Manchester, where they were able to extract a single graphene layer out of graphite. Okay, I'm not going to talk about the experimental details of this, because it would take me there are so many things to talk about on the experimental side. But essentially, soon after that, Andreas' group and Philip Kim's group, who is also here, they measured exactly that quantization, proving actually, in fact, that you have these Dirac-like particles in graphene. This is essentially, in fact, this is like diagnostics, if you want, of the existence of these Dirac particles. Okay? All right. So, but now, of course, this opens up doors for problems that people in relativistic quantum mechanics was worried about in the times of Dirac. Okay? So, because now you can do relativistic physics at low velocities. Some sense, because the Fermi's velocity, as you see, is essentially the velocity of light divided by 300. But the thing is that the system has this internal relativistic structure that you can play with. Okay, so that's the beauty of this from this perspective. Okay, so for instance, so there is talk about various different problems where we can go back to what people were asking 1927, 1928, something like that. They're asking about, for instance, the weirdness of relativistic quantum mechanics, okay? Of course, in the beginnings of quantum mechanics, all this was very strange, and people have to do with problems associated with that. So for instance, a famous problem that you find in any textbook in relativistic quantum mechanics is the so-called Klein paradox. Okay, so this is a very simple, it's one of the simplest problems in quantum mechanics, a simple barrier. Okay, so imagine you have, so this is called Klein paradox. So essentially imagine you're sending a current through a barrier like this. So this has some potential V. Right, so you have some incident current, you have some transmitted current or a reflected current, and you have some transmitted current here. Okay, so this is a very simple problem. As you can see, the wave functions are straightforward. Oh, by the way, this angle here is exactly is the arctangent of ky over kx. So this is the angle in momentum space. So the thing that conservation of probability tells you that this has to be true. Okay? But if you calculate what is the transmitted current in this geometry, you find it's negative. So actually, the reflected current is bigger than the incident current. That's what's called Klein paradox. Okay, and of course, this has to do with the fact that, so for instance, if you have, here you have some, the Dirac cone. In this region here, the Dirac cone is shifted upwards because of the potential. So you have to deal with the antiparticle states, which for us in condensed matter is something very trivial. It's just the whole states of the problem. And the interesting thing here is that, so if this is a part...
You probably mean that this section is there, and it should also be on this horizontal line. Otherwise,
what is the... You're right. Yeah. No, yeah. I didn't draw it... Yeah, you're absolutely right. So you have to shift everything upwards. Right?
The section is on the line, it should be on the line, yes.
And then what happens here is that the... So if the electron state here has some positive chirality on this side, it's going to have a state with a whole state with the opposite chirality inside of the barrier. So in fact, you can find transmission through the barrier, okay, which is a kind of strange, but it has to do with the fact that you produce antiparticle states in the process. Okay, so this is the Klein paradox. And another related problem in relativistic quantum mechanics is so-called Zitterbewegung, which has to do with the what's called the jittery motion of the wave function if you try to localize the Dirac particle. Okay, so essentially it's known that you can only localize a Dirac particle in a distance bigger than the Compton wavelength, which is 1, in relativistic quantum mechanics, 1 over the mass of the particle. So essentially, you have an actual massive spectrum which is separated by a gap proportional to the mass of the particle. Right? So you have square root of Vf k square plus m something like that, and if you and essentially you can only localize if you're here in the gap between these two states. But in graphene, the gap is zero, so the Compton wavelength is infinite. So it's a so in some sense, in particle physics language, it's an ultra relativistic regime. Okay, and in this case, for instance, this is one of the things we have looked at. So if you have, for instance, a geometry of a hole bar, and you make this hole bar narrow enough, okay, what happens is that the Dirac spectrum is completely modified by the confining potential of the edge. So essentially, you lose the Zitterbewegung from the point of view of condensed matter is the loss of relativistic invariance due to the confinement, if you want. So for instance, if you look at the spectrum, suppose you start, you have an infinite strip of size L, the spectrum looks like this, and I'm pretty sure you're going to see these plots many, many times, but because of the lateral confinement, what happens is that you have sub-bands, right? So the people who work in carbon nanotubes knows this very, very well. And so you have different sub-bands. But once you add the confining potential on top of this, this spectrum changes. Okay? So, in fact, this goes to something you can compute, but to compute that, you have to actually go back to the tight binding description, to the lattice description, and calculate. Because obviously, this will depend on details of the physics at the order of the lattice spacing. And if you compute, and you can do this for graphene, there is absolutely no problem, you get strange dispersions like that. So something like this, things like that. So essentially, it just means that you have you lose this relative state invariance. You lose. You are working on the wrong basis of states. That's what it means from that point of view. Of course, if you're talking about particles in vacuum with infinite, essentially the spectrum which goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, it's going to look strange when you look at the wave function.
So he also lost electron symmetry.
Right. Because the confining potential always breaks particle hole symmetry. Imagine you apply a positive, very large positive potential. Right. But then, okay. But yeah. This, what I'm saying is that it's if the, okay. There is a question of how smooth the potential is, how sharp.
Just cutting the bonds.
But if you cut the bonds, what you have electrostatic potentials that build at the edge. Okay? All right? You cannot avoid that. Right? So this is an interesting thing. I don't think anyone has measured anything strange like that so far. Maybe you have to go to very narrow graphene strips to do that. Okay, and finally, I'm going to mention another problem that is not very much discussed in the literature, which has to do with the hydrogen atom, the relativistic hydrogen atom, which is also a problem that we all have to do in our field theory course. And you might remember, if you solve the Dirac Hamiltonian for the 3D, now it's the three-dimensional Dirac problem for a charge. So imagine you put some charge, positive charge Z, E here the origin, and you solve for the electron motion around, there is a very famous result that shows that there are no solutions of the real solutions for the spectrum if Z, the charge of the nucleus, is bigger than 1 over the fine structure constant. Okay?
So
if you don't remember, just go to it. It's on Zuber page something, and it's there. Okay? So this problem, it's very famous. And this is somewhat related with this, Zitterbewegung. The fact that if the Coulomb potential becomes too confining, okay, you cannot keep the electrons there anymore. All right? But for QED, this is not a very stringent constraint because the fine structure constant is 137. One over it is 137. Okay? So, no big deal. Okay? But for graphene, okay? So now you ask about graphene. Well, first of all, graphene is going to be the 2D version of this. And I have to tell you that I looked in the literature and I couldn't find the solution of the hydrogen atom, the relativistic hydrogen atom in two dimensions. Okay? You can actually work it out, and it's a complicated solution in terms of hypergeometric functions and things like that. But there is a stage you cannot solve the equation. The equation becomes too complicated to be solved in the usual way. And I couldn't find the literature. If someone here knows about this, I would love to know. But the point that I want to make is the following. Is you have exactly the same issue associated with the confinement of these Dirac particles. But in graphene, the condition is that this is 1 over...
Sorry, by 2D you mean 1 over log R?
1 over R in two dimensions. 1 over R, Coulomb in two dimensions. So now, so you have the same thing, but now it's the graphene fine structure constant, but because the velocity is 300 times smaller, this is essentially 300 divided by 137, so number of order 2. I'm sorry, wrong. 137 divided by 300, so it's other half. So there is no way to confine Dirac particles. There's no bound state solution for that problem in two dimensions. That's what it means. Even a proton.
You're saying that the relevant alpha here is 2?
It's 2. It's 2. Exactly. Because this alpha is E over H bar C. Right? E squared, thank you. It's the ratio of the Coulomb energy to the kinetic energy. Right? In graphene, you have to replace C by the velocity, Fermi velocity. So in graphene, this is E squared over H bar Vf.
Didn't you fix the dispersion relation, but you stuck an extra charge?
Yeah, I mean, if I go back to your Hamiltonian there, I see E over C. I don't see E over V.
No, it's because now you have to add the potential V of R. And this potential is Ze squared over R. It's the Coulomb potential. So essentially, this shows that even a proton, even a single proton on top of a graphene sheet is going to do something weird.
But if that'd be a solution to me, it's
good. I want to see the solution. So if anyone, this is a great audience.
But there's a huge vacuum polarization, so to speak.
That's the point. But you could still try to solve the problem without the vacuum, simple Coulomb problem, like you do in three dimensions, and try to solve. Right?
Experimentally, does that mean actually we don't have any usual acceptance dating if you try to convex some data?
I don't know what it means. It means it's somewhat related to Zeta Bevegon, that the Dirac-like nature of the spectrum close to a charge impurity is strongly changed by the presence of that impurity. Even a proton is too confining.
But you mentioned no localization. Okay, so are you claiming that there is no
localization? I don't claim anything. I'm just saying I knew this would cause this kind of reaction. I'm just saying, and it's good. But I'm just saying that a simple Dirac Hamiltonian in two dimensions with a Coulomb potential is has some weird effects. Just the, no, I'm saying the Dirac equation, just the mass. Yeah, you can solve a massless case.
I'm sorry, this is the massless
case. Yeah, this is the massless case.
No, are you saying you
cannot
solve the
question? I can't. Okay, let me move on. Okay, so this is something quite interesting. And now, as I said, so this is the kind of things that you can think about in this context. But one of the questions that we condensed matter physicists ask ourselves all the time is whether graphene is really crystalline. Okay? Because there is, it's known that at finite temperatures you cannot have long-range order, crystalline long-range order in two dimensions. Right? So this was something that people asked when Andrea and his group did these experiments. People ask, well, is this really a crystalline system? Maybe it's not crystalline. So what's going on? So actually, this connects graphene problem with soft condensed matter, of issues in soft condensed matter, of membranes, for instance. Right? So if you have, and this is a wonderful reference that actually Andre gave to me. It's a book by Dave Nelson on this issue. So if you imagine, I want to go through this because this is quite interesting. So imagine you have a membrane, a classical problem, just a membrane, some membrane here in free space. Okay? And you ask yourself whether you can, this membrane is going to be stable, just due to thermal fluctuations. Okay? So one, the usual way to describe these things is to use the, what's called Monge parametrization. So you have X, Y, say, and here Z. And you describe, for instance, a position in the membrane as a function of this variable, which is the height variable. Okay? So a position in this membrane is a vector, say, a two-dimensional vector in the plane, and H, which is a function of R itself. It's called Monge parametrization. Okay? And at this point, on this membrane, there is a normal, a vector which is normal to this surface. All right, and you can actually write this vector in terms of H. Okay, now it's a three-dimensional vector, it's not two. And this is, you can write, is, if I'm not wrong, it's, let's see, it's the gradient of H minus 1 divided by 1 plus, yeah, there you go. Okay, so this is the normal vector. You can prove this very easily, that that's the case. So what happens here is the following, is that the thermal fluctuations depend on the energy associated with the fluctuations of the curvature of this membrane, right? So if I coarse grain this membrane in some way, right? And then I write the energy as a function, for instance, of, so let's call this Ni, this Nj, the energy of associating with distorting this membrane is essentially just minus some constant sum over, say, nearest neighbors, Ni dot Nj. So it's exactly like in a ferromagnet. Okay? So the energy wants to orient all these vectors in the same direction. So if you write this in terms of the height variable, this is a simple exercise, you can show that this energy, or free energy, is some constant integral over two dimensions of the Laplacian of H squared. Okay? For small deviations from flat distribution. Now, with this, we can actually learn a lot about the fluctuations, the thermal fluctuations in the system. So suppose you want to compute the mean square deviation from flat. Okay? So this is just a thermal problem. You can show that this is T over 2 pi integral D to Q, okay? And then 1 over kappa Q to the fourth. So this Q to the fourth comes from this Laplacian squared. You can convince yourselves of that. It's very simple, okay? And you see that this integral here, so this T is for temperature. So this goes like T dQ. So this goes like 1 over Q cubed. So this quantity does not converge in the infrared. Okay? Does not converge in the infrared. So I have to cut off the infrared by 1 over the size of the system, which is the smallest wave vector I can have. And you see that this goes like T times L squared. So this means that a free membrane in space cannot have the fluctuations diverge with the size of the system square. All right? And no, you're confusing it. Just wait. Now you can ask yourself if there is, this is just structural order. You can ask if there is directional order. If these vectors now point on average in the same direction. So in that case, you can see that this changes in this wave vector is going to be proportional to the gradient squared. So if I calculate something like delta n squared, which is the variance of the directional vector, this is going to be proportional to the gradient squared. And if you do the same story, you're going to get dq, but now I have two derivatives. So I get, see, q squared divided by q cubed, fourth. Q squared over q fourth. Q cubed. Q dq plus q squared. So this is logarithmic divergent. Okay, so this goes like t log of the size of the system. So what this means is that you cannot have directional order either. And in fact, that's what creates overhangs in membranes. So membranes want to fold, okay? Because this directional vector goes all over the place. It comes from that. All right, so essentially, there can be no order for graphene floating vacuum, okay? Of course, but graphene is not floating vacuum. Graphene is on top of something, or like the experiments that were done, you can put on scaffolds, for instance, and ask what happens. Then what happens is the following, is that you have tension. Okay? So now you have tension applied, like in a sheet of paper, right? I can apply tension to the sheet, right? And if you write in terms of the energy, you have to add another term to this, which is something which looks like this. Like, it goes like the gradient now. Okay? Then what happens is that it brings down in the infrared this momentum dependence by 2. Right? So if I do the same calculation now, I have dq, so this now goes like log. So I cannot have structural order. Graphene has to buckle. However, you see that for this one, the integral is convergent. It's finite. So you don't have structural order, but you have directional order of the graphene sheet. So on average, these normal vectors have an expectation value. Okay? So, of course, if you put this now on top of a substrate, there's going to be extra terms associated with the van der Waals interaction of the graphene sheet with the substrate, right? And you can add, for instance, people in soft condensed matter, they study this, it's well known. You can add terms which are something like this. Some number, and then h minus s squared. So essentially, it's the interaction between the surface and the graphene sheet. And clearly, this is going to kill every single singularity you have. Because now it's like in a massive theory. And you can get... What's going to happen is that the graphene sheet is going to follow the substrate. But of course, there is going to be some smoothing due to these terms like that. Okay? So anyway... No matter what, this problem, now, as you see, the question is that how does this impact on the electrons? Right? So it's an interesting thing. So now graphene connects soft condensed matter with hard condensed matter in some way, right? Because now if I have some fluctuating structure like that, as I said, these pi orbitals, they're essentially perpendicular to the... They're in the direction of the normal vector, if you want. Okay? And now you're going to have orbitals which are rotated from each other. And this, of course, affects the overlap of the wave functions immediately. Okay? And let me see.
Substrate or
doesn't matter, right? Because as I argued, if the substrate is rough, it's going to follow the substrate and it's going to be rough, say, right? It doesn't matter. If there is no substrate, it's just rough because of the thermal fluctuations anyway. So, as I said, if the graphene was perfectly flat, the hopping, the Fermi velocity is 3/2 times the hopping. Right? So actually, you see that this formation of the angles between the orbitals is affecting the hopping amplitude, so it's going to affect the velocity. Okay? So you can write down, you can show that the Hamiltonian, in fact, in the presence of this couples as a vector potential. It turns out. Okay, so the surface undulations coupled to the electric propagation as a vector potential. So you have some electrodynamics where the gauge fields is quenched.
Sign the same for both the points?
No, it can change sign. So essentially you have to solve some weird electrodynamics to understand that. Right? I'm sorry? It couples, yes, because of course phonons are distortions of the lattice as well. But this is not dynamic. This is static. Okay? This is static. It has to do exactly with this kind. No, it doesn't. It's not the gauge invariant anymore. Okay? It's not. Okay, but in fact, now there is also something what's deeply related to this is also the fact that in graphene, you can have, I have only 5 minutes, right? So in graphene, you can have, besides fluctuations of this sort, you can also have defects of the lattice. Okay? And as you can see, defects of the lattice that produce changes in the structure will couple to the electrons as gauge fields. So famous examples of that are pentagons and heptagons. Okay? So I'm getting close to space-time singularities now.
You didn't really answer the question why this is a gauge.
It couples. So what happens is this. When you calculate the change of this, so the actual hopping is the bare hopping plus some delta T. Okay? So when you project this out, and it's a bit technical. So, but when you project this out around these cones, which are at finite momentum, it turns out that you get something which has real and imaginary part. Okay? It couples to the hopping, but because there is a phase associated with the fact that these cones are at a finite momentum, they change in space. So in fact, this A here, I'm defining an A which has AX, it's as if this delta T projected at momentum has a real and imaginary part. And the real part is associated with the X component of this vector, and the Y component is associated with the imaginary component of this modulation. Okay, if someone is interested, I can show how this works. It's extremely simple mathematics. Okay, but it's not a gauge invariant thing. Okay? No, it's Hermitian. But it breaks time reversal.
Huh? A is real.
A it now is real. It's a two component.
No, but not gauge invariant. I mean, and the question is if A were a distortion of the lattice, which was a pure gauge.
It's not.
If it was,
yes.
It would be, have no effect on the spectrum.
Right, but this has.
So the question is, why is that?
Right.
Physically, why is a distortion, which looks like a distortion,
right,
have no effect on the spectrum?
No, it does. So that's the point. So now, this is not a pure gradient. This is not a pure gradient.
It was pure gradient.
If it was, yes, exactly. Right. But it's not.
But a pure gradient distortion is a distortion. Question is, why is a pure gradient A or delta T?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, wouldn't a pure gradient give a delta T a change in the angles between the overlaps?
Well, that's the point. It comes exactly because of that. There is a relative angle theta here, and this guy is proportional to cosine of that angle. Okay? All right. So, but now this is in real space. You have to go to momentum space, and everything is happening close to the Dirac point, which is at finite momentum. Yeah.
I think a pure gradient will couple to that, but at higher order. So it
right.
Change the parameter velocity for it, but not at zero momentum.
Right. It's related to the Gaussian curvature, exactly.
My question was, who is the curl of the day?
It's some fourth order derivative of that variable H. Okay? Something complicated. Okay. So let me go to this as an interesting issues associated with curvature now. Because, for instance, let me just give you an example. So if you have perfect graphene sheet, and you make a pentagon, for instance, by eliminating this carbon here and reconnecting these two, you see that the only way you can do that is by eliminating all the atoms in that region there, and that causes the graphene sheet to buckle. In the case of the pentagon, it forms our sphere. Okay, so it's a positive curvature effect. If you add the heptagon, which is adding now, okay, one more, you create a negative curvature, a saddle, something like that. Okay? And this, so these are like monopoles, if you want, and they couple through a gauge field. So this actually, it's a work that Gonzalez, Gnevo, Vosmediano did long time ago, for instance, to study fullerenes. Right? You can describe the spectrum of a fullerene as a Dirac problem on a sphere. Okay? So you can think of that problem as a problem of a gauge field, of the Dirac fermions moving on a gauge field. So there are other types of defects which are possible, which are essentially combinations of pentagons and heptagons and things like this. So just to close, I don't think I have more time. Of course, we have so many things to discuss, but let me give you an idea, since many of you are interested in singularities. So actually, this was an idea proposed by Jose Gonzalez some time ago to me, to us, in a Marsh meeting. So imagine now you have two graphene sheets, like that. And now you take a carbon nanotube, and you pass across. Okay? So you can do that by adding pentagons at this at the event horizon. Okay? So actually, you can play with these things. If, you know, the chemists or whoever is able to make something as beautiful as that, a wormhole, we don't know. But, you know, you can manipulate this material. Maybe in, I don't know, a few years, we're going to see something interesting like that. Like a time machine. There you go. On graphene. All right. Thank you very much for your attention. Transistors. I didn't have time to go into the transistors. It depends if you want to make money out of it or not, right? Or maybe you can make a lot of money with time machines too. So now actually, you know, to of course you could think of using a single graphene layer as a way to create a device, and people are doing that, but you see, to make devices in the way they work these days, you need a gap in the spectrum. You need to be able to introduce a gap in the spectrum in some way. And of course, in graphene, there is a way, which is to break the sublattice symmetry. If you break the sublattice symmetry, you immediately generate a gap in the spectrum. But to break a sublattice symmetry on a graphene sheet is far from trivial because it's energetically extremely hard. It costs a lot of energy to dimerize, for instance, the graphene sheet or so on. So one way to do that is actually to go to the bilayer. I don't have time to discuss the bilayer with you, but I can briefly say that in the bilayer, the spectrum is still relativistic but massive. Okay? So in the bilayer, instead of two bands, you have four. And these bands have relativistic dispersion with a finite mass. But there is no gap. Even there's no gap because two bands touch in a point. But if you make an imbalance of charge between the two graphene layers, a gap opens. So actually, and this depends on the potential that you put between the two layers. So actually, you can control the gap. And this has been actually already experimentally being demonstrated that you can do that also at Andre Geim's group in Manchester, that you can create a tunable semiconductor that way. So actually, I have to say that, for instance, to me, the bilayer graphene physics is even more interesting, and because it's also more involved. But you know, but this would be a new seminar, would be, you know, for some other time. And I'm sure that you're going to be able to hear about that during the conference. Yes.
The whole analysis was one electron.
Yes.
But they were purely anti-Coulomb interactions. Why can that be completely
irrelevant? No. Well, yeah, that's a good question. And actually, it's a very good question.
There is a good answer to that.
Okay.
If they're weak enough, they're actually, strictly speaking, irrelevant. Even the Coulomb interaction is irrelevant.
Is marginally relevant.
Marginally.
Yes.
You talked about putting the sheet under tension to stabilize it. What if, is there a self-induced term like that in the Hamiltonian? Maybe smaller than what you're thinking about, but it's produced by the system itself.
We are saying like to break the symmetry, to break the
squared.
No, I think he's talking about the gradient term. This one.
Yeah, like, so this is... Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you think, if you're just writing down the general function all of H, you'd expect the energy of... How would you expect a term like that would be?
The wrong sign.
Yeah, well, the sign depends whether you were pushing the sheet of paper.
No, like on its own.
Huh?
You generate the term on its own.
On its own? Yeah. From where?
Because it's a level.
Well, it could be related to the effect you talked about after. Once you're talking about bending it enough, other effects come in.
Yeah, it's true that the electronic motion couples to the curvature. And it's the coupling between these two things that can stiffen the graphene sheet. Yes.
So yeah. Is there some estimate of how big R is? Is self-induced R?
No, there is no.
This is an analog of the cosmological constant.
Yes, I'm aware. Yes, that's another one.
Do you know any three-dimensional lattice that would have Dirac points instead of
certain lines? I heard about something. André, do you know?
Rake claimed that some of semiconductor zero can be by pressure or by compositional changes can be placed in sort of 3D state. I looked through literature and didn't find any simple one like that, but apparently there could be. And one of the examples of very close system is graphite itself. Now people found Dirac fermions in graphite and recently some semiconductors. Again, semiconductor. So all what you need, that one band crosses with another band, and then you get this spin of description, and that's it. So with the benefit of hindsight, you can apply to a Dirac fermions in any system.
That's your point.
Okay. Yes.
Come back to this last thing that you had.
This one?
Yeah. How much of it is understood theoretically? I mean, I was wondering about, for example, letting off. So, do you understand boundary conditions or what happens to density on the other side? Is this so? What are the features?
Yeah?
Like a photonic sort of test part. You won't say anything.
Well, you know. All right. Thank you.